You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Explorers Podcast. Today we start a new series, this on French explorer and naturalist Jules Dumont d'Urville. But before we get going, I want to tell you about a fun giveaway that I've put together with some very nice people, which is related to our subject. Let me tell you a story. Last year, I was contacted by someone who wanted to advertise on the podcast. The woman was helping with the publication of a new book called Daring French Explorations by Hubert Sagnier. The book is 400 pages of absolutely beautiful material from a bunch of expeditions led by French explorers between 1714 and 1854. This includes people such as Louis-Antoine de Bougainville, a contemporary of James Cook, and the first Frenchman to circumnavigate the globe. Daring French Explorations is really cool in that it's like a big coffee table book. It's huge. Sagnier has collected all sorts of stunning images from these voyages, some never before published. We are talking about drawings and engravings originally done by those involved with the expedition. It's everything from maps to documents to sketches of landscapes, birds, animals, people, and everything in between. It's gorgeous. And each of these stories is told through extracts from travel journals and letters and diaries from the explorer. If you are a history nerd or have one in the family, Daring French Explorations would be something amazing to have for your collection. It is super cool. Anyhow, I was asked about advertising the book on the show. And instead of doing that, I offered up a different idea. Let's instead do a giveaway of the book. And at the same time, let's cover one of these daring French explorers, hence today's subject, Jules Dumont d'Urville, who is in the book. It's a fun thank you to all of you who listen and support the show. So that is what we are doing. In the podcast notes, as well as on our website, explorerspodcast.com, there is a link to a page about daring French explorations, which includes some great images. Just go there to look at them. Anyhow, on the site, you can enter the giveaway. It's nice and simple. Enter your name and email, and when the series is done, we will randomly pick a winner. You can also buy the book if you want, as there's a link for that as well. Also, I want you to know that I don't get anything for this other than a copy of this wonderful book, which is awesome and I love to show off to people when they come by. So go to explorerspodcast.com/daringfrenchexplorations and sign up for the giveaway. It is absolutely free to enter, and there are no obligations. As I said, once the series is over, we will pick a winner and send him or her a copy of the book. And if you hear this and the giveaway is already over, well, I'll leave the website up so you can check out the book, because it's worth it. Now, before we get going, I have one note for you about the series on Jules Dumont d'Urville, and that is about the source material. Books by d'Urville, or about him, are hard to come by in English. There are lots of things in French, but not English. Thankfully, there are a few decent English language sources, but I want to mention one in particular. It is titled Dumont d'Urville, Explorer and Polymath by Edward Diker. His 2014 biography is just amazing. It is one of the most thorough reads of any explorer I have ever covered from this era. Diker's book is an absolute trove of information on d'Urville and his explorations. He really dug into his subject, and it means I have lots of details I can talk about that lets us nerd out about the man and this era. I have listed the book on the website. Diker, by the way, does the foreword to Daring French Explorations. Okay, that is it for notes. Let's get going with today's episode on Jules Sébastien César Dumont d'Urville. Now, the first thing you are probably wondering about is who the heck is Jules Dumont d'Urville? And the short and simple answer is that from 1822 to 1840, he circumnavigated the globe three times, twice leading expeditions of discovery. And as a fun side note, he played an important role in the acquisition of the famed Venus de Milo statue on behalf of the French government in 1820, which we will talk about today. Jules Dumont d'Urville was born on May 23, 1790, in Condé-sur-Noir-Haut in Lower Normandy. His father was Gabriel Charles François Dumont Sieur d'Urville. He held the hereditary job of bailiff in his community, meaning he was responsible for the application of the law in the region. As noted, this was a hereditary title, meaning the family had held it for more than a century. It was not a position of nobility, but it was important. As for nobility, Jules's mother would cover that. Jeanne Choisy came from Choisy, France. She was from an old and noble family, tracing her lineage all the way back to Charlemagne and other Frankish kings. She was tall and blonde, a hint at her Viking heritage. Gabrielle was 26 years older than his wife, but they would have 9 children, 4 of which survived to adulthood, 2 boys and 2 girls. It was d'Urville's mother who would be a big influence on her son. The woman came from an old, staunch, conservative Catholic family. She was rigid and proud, and carried herself with the confidence of a woman of noble birth. The d'Urville family was thus respected as rural nobility by the local people. However, the French Revolution would change many things. The first was the abolition of feudal rights, such as hereditary jobs, like bailiff. Jules's father, who was 62 when his son was born in 1790, was already suffering from health issues when he found himself out of a job and career. The family would move to Vassy to the west. The revolution resulted in the confiscation of property of the church and nobility, and as old guard royalist types, people such as the d'Urvilles were hit with special taxes. Jeanne d'Urville would be forced to swallow her pride on numerous occasions as she hated the revolution, including the persecution of Catholic clergy. She would be arrested after accidentally, using air quotes there, throwing a chamber pot on some passing revolutionaries. She spent a week in jail for that before being released. But things would get worse as radicals gained more and more influence. When they took a look at Jeanne d'Urville, they found her lacking. She refused to attend events extolling the glory of the revolution, and it came out that her brother had been a member of the king's bodyguard, and another brother was, gasp, a bishop. Add in her family's history and the recent chamber pot incident, and she was arrested and tossed into prison as an enemy of the revolution. Louis XVI would be executed in 1793, and it was not long before civil war engulfed much of France, including the areas of Normandy, the Vendée, and Brittany, right in the heart of the d'Urville home. Jeanne d'Urville would ultimately get released and put under house arrest, but she would escape and the family would flee for a time. At least that's the story we sort of figure out. These times are pretty murky. Anyhow, the fighting in the north of France would eventually die down once the radicals in Paris were overthrown. And in time, peace came back to Normandy and the d'Urville family would return to their home. Then in 1796, Jules's father would die. This would put the boy even more into the orbit of his mother, but also an uncle, the abbot of Choisy. The man would be a steady and guiding influence on Jules, teaching him Greek, Latin, rhetoric, and philosophy. Jules Dumont d'Urville was driven hard by his mother. She believed it would make him tough and resolute in a turbulent world. She also taught him not to trust others, as she and her peers had been betrayed often in the past decade. He thus developed a very calm and measured approach to the world. Most people saw him as serious, shy, and calm, even cold. He did not make many friends. All of his life, d'Urville would be seen as distant and humorless. As a youth, d'Urville would thrive in the outdoors. He was a tall, robust, and blonde young boy. He loved to wander the countryside all day, investigating places and nature. He also became a good swimmer, horseman, and swordsman. Another thing he inherited from his mother was ambition, some would say arrogance. He envisioned himself doing great things. One thing he did not excel in was the social graces. As I noted, he was shy and didn't mix well with others. To add to this, he didn't pay much attention to his physical appearance. His clothing was often ill-suited and sloppy. Even when he became an officer in the French Navy, he would shun the typical clothing of an officer, instead going for common clothing, which was more suited to his work as a naturalist. Jules Dumont d'Urville would get his first taste of naval service at the age of 9, when he was given a place on a 16-gun cutter in Brittany, which is the area that pokes out into the west of France. The ship was, however, mostly confined to port due to the British blockade. Although d'Urville did see some action in 1801, his ship being damaged and forced to head back to port. So why was d'Urville in the Navy at such a young age? The answer is that he got there through family connections. The idea was to enroll a youngster in the Navy early, allowing him to potentially develop into an officer. This was a first step for Derville. His uncle, the abbot in particular, would help him get good appointments in the coming years. Derville would continue his service in the Navy, and from 1802 to 1804, he served on the Les Deux Amis as a novice sailor. At the same time, he continued his studies. He became a voracious reader, something he would remain for the rest of his life. He devoured history and the classics. He also adored novels, and he proved to have an outstanding memory, reciting Homer by heart. He also continued studying math and science. His mother wanted him to be a priest, but Derville's uncle kept him on the path of education and ultimately the Navy. By the way, when Napoleon became emperor, he mended the rift between the Catholic Church and France. This allowed the church to reintegrate itself into French society and become the official religion of the nation. Old royalists, such as Derville's mother and her family, rejoiced. In 1804, Derville continued his formal education in the new system established by Napoleon. The idea was to create a curriculum that would train a new generation of military and civilian leaders.
These schools were called lycées. Derville entered the Lycée Imperial de Caen, where he showed a great promise in math, literature, science, and languages.
He also read about the voyages of Bougainville and Cook, and was fascinated by these great expeditions to the far corners of the world. Derville's goal was to get into the elite École Polytechnique. The school specialized in engineering and science, but had been militarized by Napoleon's regime. And while many thought he was a shoo-in for the school, he was ultimately rejected because he failed his physical test. Also, it might have been that some saw him as too timid and lacking in leadership and social skills. I mention the latter because Derville would develop a reputation for being blunt, and not in a good way. He showed little tact, and he simply failed to understand the nuances of peer-to-peer relationships. It is something that will dog him his entire life. He was instead offered a position at the Military Academy at Fontainebleau, but Derville was not particularly interested in life in the army. Unlike so many of his peers, the idea of fighting and killing others for the glory of Napoleon was not what rocked his boat. Thus, he turned down the offer, and in 1807, he rejoined the Navy. He reported to the French naval base in Brest, where he was assigned the rank of aspirant provisoire, which is anyone who was on track to become an officer. Despite being in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, the French Navy was woefully underfunded, undermanned, and outgunned. After the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805, the French never faced the British in a large-scale naval engagement during the Napoleonic era. Great Britain and her allies ruled the seas. So Derville and most of the remaining elements of the French Navy stayed in port and under the protection of the local forts. They might slip past the British blockade on occasion or go out on little sorties, but not much else. Derville would thus study. His ability with languages was astounding, and he continued to master Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Also, there were extensive botanical gardens in the area, and he nurtured his interest in the natural sciences. In time, he would pass his officer's exams and become an élève de la marine, which is roughly the equivalent of a midshipman. He drew a salary of 600 francs a year. Derville would spend the next few years serving on various ships, but life in the Navy was mostly confined to port due to the blockade. On one frigate, he did get to see Napoleon Bonaparte, who came aboard to inspect the vessel. Derville was not impressed by the emperor. In fact, Derville would ultimately prove to be a product of the French Revolution. Despite the family's noble past, he would embrace republican ideas as he got older. He would, however, avoid extremism on both sides of the political spectrum. In 1810, Derville would be sent to the naval base in Toulon on the south coast of France on the Mediterranean. He took a liking to the city, which was just east of Marseille. Also, he received a promotion, the title roughly equivalent to midshipman first class. In Toulon, Derville would be posted on the 80-gun Suffren and actually spend quite a bit of time at sea. He also would continue to study and learn. There was math, physics, astronomy, and chemistry. Also, he dove into languages, adding English, German, Italian, Russian, and Chinese to Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. His ability with languages will prove invaluable to him when sifting through all the dialects he will encounter in Polynesia and Melanesia. Derville would also become immersed in the natural sciences, including botany and entomology. And then in 1811, Derville would meet a fellow officer, Louis-Isidore Dupré, who would play an important role in his life. As I mentioned earlier, Derville was not the kind of person who made friends easily. People saw him as grumpy and reserved. He was the kind of person that was hard to like. However, Derville and Dupré hit it off and soon were friends. Dupré was imaginative and forceful, traits Derville lacked. The two would have an on-again, off-again friendship, as Dupuré could also be overly critical and condescending, something that didn't sit well with the overly sensitive Derville. But I want to mention the man now, because by the end of today's episode, he will be very important. Derville would continue to be stationed in Toulon, and he would be promoted in 1812 to the rank of ensign. In 1814, while waiting for a new ship, the young Derville would meet Adelaide Pepin, the 16-year-old daughter of a local watchmaker and optician. Soon, he would ask her to marry him, and she agreed. Now, this has often been portrayed as a bit of a scandal, as Derville's mother believed the girl was beneath him, socially. Adelaide's parents were divorced, a big no-no for Derville's very Catholic mother. And when you dig around a bit, you'll find that Adelaide's parents had been married when her mother was 5 months pregnant. More scandal. But Jules Derville was insistent. This was the love of his life, and in reality, it was. Through their letters, you will see a couple that were intensely devoted to one another. Now, at this time, in the French Navy, you had to have your superior's permission to marry, and those superiors needed the officer's parents' permission, meaning Derville's mother. That posed a problem. She could say no and end everything. Derville, however, had a nuclear option available to him. He could simply leave the Navy if anyone objected. And thus, all sides gave the couple their blessing in January 1815. Adelaide brought a dowry of 8,500 francs into the marriage, 3,500 from her father, 5,000 from her mother. The two were wed in May of 1815. A son was born less than a year later, Jules Eugène Gustave. As I said, the marriage was a happy one, although some have claimed that it would be a source of estrangement between Derville and his mother. That may very well be true, but I don't doubt that its continual drift from the conservative royal world of his mother to that of a republican and liberal were just as likely as a reason for any sort of rift between mother and son. So Derville was now a father, and 1815 also brought the end of Napoleon, who was exiled to the middle of the South Atlantic Ocean, never to return. This finally brought peace to Europe after more than 20 years. The Bourbon Restoration, under the rule of Louis XVIII, was underway. This transition also allowed France to turn its attention to exploration, which had been severely lacking for a quarter of a century. In 1817, Louis de Freycinet was given the command of the corvette Uranie with orders to circumnavigate the globe. This was the chance that Derville was waiting for. A proposed three-year voyage to South America, the South Pacific, and Australia to gather information in the fields of geography, ethnology, astronomy, magnetism, and meteorology, and for collecting plants and animal specimens. Derville put in a request to be part of the expedition. When no word came, he even contacted Freycinet directly, appealing for a position. In the end, he was rejected, and to rub salt into his wounds, his old friend, Louis-Isidore Dupuré, was selected over him. Dejected, Derville would find refuge in botany, spending more and more time at the Navy's botanical gardens in Toulon. The garden's director, Gaspard Robert, would become Derville's friend and mentor. And then in 1819, Derville, now 29 years old, would finally get his first real chance to go on a scientific expedition. And it would, of all things, link him to one of history's most famous pieces of art, the Venus de Milo.
Eating better and healthier is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. We are talking chef-crafted and dietitian-approved and ready in just a couple of minutes. Factor offers 35 options every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. And there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. So what are you waiting for? Get started with Factor today and get after your goals. It is so easy. Great food in just 2 minutes. These are no prep, no mess meals that are ready to heat and eat. Another point, Factor is less expensive than takeout and way healthier. And the best part is they taste great. My wife says Factor meals are food with flavor. So if you give Factor a try, we can save you 50% off your first box. Head to factormeals.com/explorers50 and use code explorers50 to get 50% off. That's code explorers50 at factormeals.com/explorers50 to get 50% off. Enjoy the goodness. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. In 1819, Captain Pierre Gautier du Parc was given command of the Chevrette, a former military livestock ship. His orders were to conduct a hydrographic study of the Greek islands. Derville would be one of his officers. Hydrography, by the way, is the branch of applied sciences which deals with the measurement and description of the physical features of oceans, seas, coastal areas, lakes, and rivers. And here, Derville would find a perfect match. He had numerous duties. He was to conduct hydrographic and astronomical observations. As the ship's naturalist, he was to collect plant and animal specimens. Also, he was designated as the ship's antiquary, which meant he was the guy to go to when there was a need to assess antiques or relics. Let's remember, Derville spoke Greek, and he was well-versed in the classical period. He was thus a great addition due to the many hats that he was able to wear. The other fit for Derville was the ship's captain, Gautier du Parc. He was a meticulous man who took his work seriously, and it would give Derville a great example of how to conduct a scientific expedition. The Chevrette would actually conduct two voyages over the next couple of years. The first expedition began on April 3, 1819, as the Chevrette sailed east into the Mediterranean towards Greece. The first stop was the volcanic Greek island of Milos in the Aegean Sea. Derville made three stops on Milos, taking great interest in the island's rich history. Everywhere there were signs of the greatness of ancient Greece. The expedition continued on, stopping at the islands of Kos, Samos, Lesbos, and Tenedos, amongst others, and sailed north into the Aegean near the Dardanelles, the strait that marks the divide between Europe and Asia. Derville would go out and collect botanical samples whenever possible, although he was laid up for several weeks at one point due to a fever. Despite that, he proved to be an enthusiastic, if still amateur, naturalist. After that, it was south towards Athens. Derville would see the Parthenon and learn more about the trade of ancient Greek artwork and relics, and that will be very helpful in a bit. The Chevrette would return to Toulon on November 15, 1819. During a two-week quarantine, Derville put together all that he'd collected. He was proud of what he had done. After wintering in France, the Chevrette would sail again on April 3, 1820. 2 weeks later, the ship was at Milos. Derville was drawn to a place called Kilma, where a marble amphitheater from the Roman era had been uncovered. He learned that nearby, a farmer had uncovered something rather interesting. Derville asked the local French vice consul, Louis Brest, to take him to the discovery. 9 days before Derville had landed on Milos, a local farmer, Theodorus Kendrotas, had uncovered the upper part of a marble statue while working in his field. A French ensign from a different visiting ship, Olivier Vutech, was nearby when the discovery was made. He paid the farmer and his sons to uncover the rest of the statue. They found the head and torso were one part. The other part, the lower half, was separate, and the arms were broken off. There was also a marble wedge that kept the top and lower halves together in a stable manner. A fragment of an arm and foot were later found as well. With the help of some sailors, the statue, save the arms, was put back together. Before the men, for the first time in 2,000 years, was Aphrodite, the Venus de Milo, one of the iconic works of Western art and history. Men like Louis Brest and Olivier Vutech knew the statue was special, but just how special, they weren't sure. Ensign Vutech pleaded with Brest to buy the statue. The latter agreed it was important, but he didn't have the funding available. Therefore, Vutech wanted his captain to immediately head to Istanbul to arrange the purchase of the statue, but that would take time. The captain had other places to be, according to his orders, and he would follow his orders. The ship would get to Istanbul, eventually. A few days later, it was Derville's turn to see the statue, and he knew right away that he was seeing a masterpiece. Derville wanted to get the statue then and there, but his captain pointed out that there was no room for it on the ship. Plus, he was concerned that the statue would not survive the winds and rough seas that their mission required. But not all the news was bad. Derville was lucky that the Chevrette was sailing immediately for Istanbul, as one of the expedition's objectives was to record the exact longitude of the city. There, Derville could bring his find to the French ambassador. On April 25th, the expedition arrived at the Dardanelles and proceeded into the Sea of Marmara and to the city of Istanbul. Even before arriving, Derville had prepared a letter about the statue, which he called Venus Victrix, or Venus Victorious. Once in Istanbul, Derville would pass on word to the French embassy about the statue, urging them to go get it before someone else did. And thus, the French ambassador's secretary, the Comte de Marcellus, would take up the cause and board a ship for Milos on May 15th with orders to purchase the statue. The vessel that he would take was the Estouffette, the ship of Olivier Vouche, who had been the first Frenchman to actually see the statue. Despite the efforts of Derville and Marcellus, the Venus would nearly get away from the French. When Marcellus arrived in Milos, the statue was already on board a brig, set to sail to Istanbul. It seems that the farmer had found another buyer, a Greek priest, who was going to send it to the Sultan of Constantinople as a gift. Marcellus went to the local clergy and argued that the farmer had already agreed to sell the statue to the French. They rebuffed the claim. Marcellus then turned to the island's primates, its leading citizens, and tried to convince them that the sale should be annulled. They would agree and offer the statue to the French for the price of 8,000 francs. Some have argued that the guns of the French warship were the biggest reason for the reversal of the sale. The fact that the transfer of the statue was conducted under the eyes of 20 French soldiers probably indicates that there was at least some coercion on the matter. The French would compose a letter explaining the situation to Greek officials so as not to have blame for the situation fall on the local clergy. It didn't help much, as three priests were ultimately flogged and fined by a local nobleman for letting the statue get away. And so the Venus de Milo was heading to France. This is a classic example of the looting of relics from places such as Greece, Turkey, and the Middle East. Some might argue that taking the statue to France would, in the long run, preserve it, and that is because many items such as these would simply disappear into private collections, which sadly happens to this day. Anyhow, Jules Dumont d'Urville still had an expedition to go on. The Chevrette would determine the location of Istanbul, then sail through the Bosphorus and into the Black Sea. There, the expedition would sail all around the region, including the Crimea, taking astronomical and magnetic readings and doing all the mapping and charting stuff. Everywhere they went, d'Urville would scramble out into the countryside and gather specimens. He was praised for his dedication to his duties. By early August, the Chevrette was back in Istanbul. The work they had done in the Black Sea was groundbreaking and would provide the world with a new generation of naval charts. They were so good and so accurate, they were used when the Allies landed in the Dardanelles in World War I, nearly a century later. The expedition stopped in Milos in early September to take advantage of an eclipse of the sun. After that, it was back to France. The men of the ship were forced to stay in quarantine for 4 weeks, as they were coming from an area where the bubonic plague was an issue. But after that, they were reunited with family and friends. D'Urville was ordered to the Hydrographic Office in Paris to assist with putting together the results of the expedition. By the way, D'Urville had returned to France with 16,000 specimens, half of which he would give away to other naturalists. It was common to collect multiples of a specimen, so you could share what you had found. He had sent a summary of his findings to various scientific groups, and in acknowledgement of his work, he was elected a member of the Académie du Var, a respected scholarly society. D'Urville's duties in Paris were difficult and time-consuming. He worked long hours, 6 days a week. It was not easy for a man of his rank and pay to support himself and a family in such a city. It made him at times bitter and angry. However, D'Urville's reputation would soar in the next year when word got out about his part in the acquisition of the Venus de Milo, which was famous even before it arrived in France. The statue would be put on display at the Louvre, the experts resisting the urge to restore any imperfections. It was hailed as one of the great masterworks of Greek art. D'Urville would, rightfully, claim he was critical to the acquisition of the Venus. It was his forceful urging to the French ambassador about the value of the statue that got a man to the island to take possession. Another day or two delay, and the Venus would have ended up elsewhere. Now, some say that D'Urville played up his part in the whole affair, which may be true, at least a bit. It's easy to cut out some of the side players, play up the stakes, that sort of thing. He certainly didn't downplay his role, but he was important. Without him, France does not get the Venus de Milo, and he worked hard to make sure people knew it. And people did notice. On June 8, 1821, D'Urville was named a Chevalier de la Légion d'Honneur, making him a Knight of France, and more good things were to come. He would give a speech detailing the Chevrette's voyage at the Academy of Science before 60 of the greatest scientists of the day. He even met the famed Alexander von Humboldt. A promotion to lieutenant and a pay raise would follow later that year. Regarding his work on the expedition, he had collected and cataloged 219 plants, which he detailed in a publication that came out in 1822. There were no new species amongst his collection. However, D'Urville's reputation as a naturalist continued to grow. And then, in the fall of 1821, D'Urville would run into his old friend, Louis-Isidore Duperrey, who had just returned from the Ourani expedition under Louis de Freycinet. The expedition had been gone for 3 years, and the ship, the Ourani, had been wrecked on the shores of the Falkland Islands. The crew had been forced to survive alone for 4 months before being rescued. Well, Duperrey would describe the places the ship had been, Australia, the Hawaiian Islands, the South Pacific, and South America. D'Urville would be enthralled, but Duperrey added something else, what the expedition had not done. Australia, New Guinea, and the Carolines, they were mostly unexplored. The two ambitious young men thus hatched a plan. They would propose an expedition to return to the Pacific to explore all the places that still lay uncharted and unknown. D'Urville would oversee the branches of natural history involved with such an expedition, while Duperrey would handle the nautical and hydrographic work. It would be an expedition lasting 2 to 3 years. They proposed that the expedition would circle the globe and in that time map and chart reefs, banks, and islands, and trace new routes through dangerous archipelagos. They would conduct magnetic and meteorological tests. There would be extensive work done surrounding the natural history of the lands, including the native peoples. The principal focus of these studies would be in the Pacific. The two men's ambitious plans soon made rounds amongst the various members of the Academy of Science in Paris, and they were enthusiastic about the venture. However, getting the Navy Department on board was another matter. People they met there were all for the voyage, but military bureaucracies at this time, as they are now, were slow, slow machines. However, the two men would eventually get a meeting with the Navy Minister in December of 1821. A few days later, their plan was, quote, adopted with enthusiasm and without modification, end quote. King Louis signed off on the expedition. Duperrey was named commander, with D'Urville second in command. The length of the voyage was estimated at 15 to 24 months. For the French crown, the expedition would identify places that could be future colonies, and this included Western Australia, which at this point was wide open for exploration. Also, identifying potential naval bases was a key military objective, while potential trading opportunities were always on everyone's minds. And so D'Urville and Duperrey would go about getting their expedition together. The first thing on the agenda was a ship, and this would be the Coquille, which means seashell. The Coquille was 10 years old, had 3 masts, 12 cannons, and came in at 380 tons. The ship would undergo a refit, which took 4 months. A 200mm or 8-inch false keel with copper sheathing was added to strengthen the hull. Iron around the ship was replaced when possible with copper to prevent interference with magnetic observations. A large distilling apparatus was installed to provide fresh water if needed. Also, a large oven was added to bake enough bread every day for the ship's men. The ship's contingent would number 72, which included 60 crewmen and a dozen officers and specialists. Each crewman was issued a greatcoat, oilskins, flannel trousers, and a vest. They also got 6 months' wages in advance to ensure that their families had funds to cover the length of the mission. The ship would take on food and supplies. This included typical ocean-going stuff, such as tins of beef and vegetables. Plus, there were goods to barter with the native people. There were also the latest navigational and scientific instruments. As for the officers and specialists of the ship, I'm not going to go into them in detail. I'll bring them up as they come into play. Like any naval expedition, some of the men were a positive, some were not. I do want to note that the Science Academy in Paris wanted to send along a couple of civilian scientists, but D'Urville fought that suggestion, and everyone agreed with him. The military didn't like civilians on their ships that could exert too much influence, and D'Urville certainly didn't want anyone to threaten his position as the expedition's expert naturalist. The expedition would thus refit the ship in the early part of 1822, add officers and crew, and gather supplies, gear, and provisions. The Coquille would depart Toulon on August 11, 1822. Now, I want to mention one thing before we go off on our round-the-world tour, and that is that D'Urville considered backing out of the expedition even before it departed. The problem was that he and Duperrey simply did not get along. Yes, the two were old friends, but that friendship had been strained at times. Duperrey could be arrogant, condescending, overly emotional, and off-putting. He also didn't like to be challenged, and he absolutely hated to be proven wrong. D'Urville held some of those same qualities, but he was also extremely sensitive to slights, real or perceived. Thus, he saw insults in the things Duperrey said and did. By the way, Duperrey could do this with everyone, so it wasn't just D'Urville. In the end, D'Urville envisioned the expedition to be a partnership,
as the two had cooked it up together. But when push came to shove, Duperrey made it clear who was the boss, and Derville took it personally. Anyhow, Derville talked it over with his wife, and she encouraged him to go on the expedition. The opportunity was just too great of a thing to pass up. Something like this might never happen again. Her husband agreed. He would do his job and bite his tongue when necessary. By the way, we will see that Derville had this shell that he could go into when he needed. It was a passive-aggressive sort of approach to things, where he would do all of his work, but he never stepped outside of his duties. He avoided confrontations, even interactions, with Duperrey, and didn't contradict him, even when he knew he was wrong. Like I said, classic passive-aggressiveness. Anyhow, it was August of 1822, and the Coquille set out into the Mediterranean. Their mission had begun. Next time, we will follow Derville as he goes on his first grand adventure, a voyage around the world. So that is a wrap for today. I hope you've enjoyed the opening episode in our series on French explorer Jules Dumont d'Urville. Thank you for listening. I will see you next time. The Explorers Podcast is part of the Airwave Media Network. Go to airwavemedia.com to find other great shows. If you like space stuff, there are several podcasts from NASA, as well as Reach, a space podcast for kids.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
History isn't black and white, yet too often it's presented as such. Grey History, The French Revolution is a long-form history podcast dedicated to exploring the ambiguities and nuances of the past. From a revolution of hope and liberty to the infamous Reign of Terror, you can't understand the modern world without understanding the French Revolution. So search for The French Revolution today.